Today is September 14th, 2016. We're at the home of Jim and Jody Wergler in Williams, Arizona. My name is Tom Martin, and this is part four of Grand Canyon Historical Society oral history interview with Jim and Jody. Jim, last time we were talking about a number of different things that were happening at the Yosemite Clinic. One was the changes of time to care, the advancements in the care in the field versus the throw and go. We were talking about some troubles with the DEA. Cheryl Pagel and the Good Sam take over the clinics, kind of some of the things that we had left with at the end of part three.
Okay, so I'm sitting here thinking, which one of those do I tackle first? And I'll go first with the issue having to do with the advancement of out-of-hospital care, which really kind of has been a revolutionary thing over the past 50 years or so, and it's still going on because of the increased ability of technology, just the notion even that an EKG can be done in the field in the back of an ambulance and transmitted to the base station, and somebody competent can read it and prescribe medication based on what they see there. And that's been going on now for at least, I don't know, 10 or 20 years, something like that. And they just keep getting better at being able to provide these things. And I had mentioned earlier that I had tried to make sure that I had nursing staff who were certified in mobile intensive care nursing, but I subsequently learned that it's more important to have nurses who were open-minded, who were eager to learn and capable of learning new things and putting them into action. And so I didn't worry so much about it. When I had good nurses, they were good in every area that we provided, and that was more important than just having initials behind the name. I'll mention the, at one point the DEA showed up one morning, and this is fairly long-winded. One morning, we took off one day a week, and then every third week we would take off a weekend plus a day on each side of the weekend. So it didn't sound quite as bad. So we would have either a 4 or 5 day weekend once every 3 weeks, but then the rest of the time it was just one day off at a time, which we valued, treasured. Usually went without shaving or combing the hair or whatever, putting on decent clothes. And the staff called me and said, there are some investigators here, and they want you to come down immediately. And they then made it clear that I didn't need to stop and brush my teeth or do anything to make myself more presentable. They wanted me there right away. Well, okay, so I went down, and it's important to note here, our house was 100 feet behind the hospital clinic, so it was readily accessible, very easy to get back and forth. One of the joys of living there, because I could, have access to the family and still do a full day's work. So I got down to the clinic, went in the back door, went into the drug room, and here were two guys sitting in the drug room, and the staff looking a little intimidated, and they were counting pills. So the way we operated the drug room, there are pills that can just be sitting out anywhere, and they don't have to be really guarded or kept track of, because they do not have any potential for abuse. So anything that belonged to the tranquilizer area, the sedative area, and particularly opioids, anything that had Demerol, any kind of codeine, anything related to these types of medicines had to be under lock and key. And so I'll finish that in a minute.
So things that would be readily available on the counter would be like steroid dose packs, anti-inflammatories, fungicides, cardiac medications. Just trying to think about what was like readily available versus what was under lock and key.
Okay, so antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, anything that they could not be out on the shelf. They were not considered over-the-counter medicines. That's a whole different category. And you walk into your Walgreens or any pharmacy, and you have miles and miles of shelves that have all sorts of things available, different names, frequently similar ingredients, but they don't require a prescription, and they don't require that you have to have a doctor's order for them. So then there's the next level up. And those are called legend. And if it says on the bottle, available by written prescription only, that's the legend. So the legend says, you know, it has to be behind a counter. The patient can't just walk in and say, I want one of those. Now, you can do that in Mexico, which is one of the reasons people go to Mexico, is because they do have ready access to the kind of things that are not necessarily available. But then there's also the medication that is considered a narcotic, and they are treated under a separate legal system, and they're called Category 1, Category 2, Category 3, Category 4, and Category 5 drugs. Category 1 is not even available to physicians, and includes marijuana. And it's one of the big issues these days is, okay, the feds say that marijuana is illegal because it's on Category 1 on the federal list of drugs. Whereas the states have chosen to say that the state law supersedes federal law in certain categories. It also includes heroin, for example. Well, nobody can walk into any drugstore in America and present a prescription for heroin. That Demerol is a derivative of heroin. And any of the other narcotic medications are in some way a derivative of heroin, which comes from poppies. So it's a whole study of its own, you know. Thank you. Pause for a drink. So anyway, we really were very careful about keeping track. When they talk about opioids now are one of the big items that are considered to be a scourge. Oxycontin, Appalachia, you know, is being just simply wiped out practically by this scourge of overuse of opioids. Those still require a prescription, and depending on what state, and people from the West Virginia area are noted. It's notorious that somebody will go down to Florida, which is notorious for having these mills, prescription mills, where people line up 50 to 100 at a time, and they walk in and request the drug they want. The doctor writes down something, says constant pain or something to justify, you know, this. They're strictly just a mill, and they're a disgrace, just a total disgrace. But in terms of our situation, we ran a drug room. The closest pharmacy was either an hour away in Oakhurst through the mountain driving, or an hour away in Mariposa, mountain driving. We're not open at night. We're not open consistently on weekends. And so we had to be in a position to be able to provide medications, even the kind that were considered, particularly for pain medication. We saw 400 fractures a year in this clinic. Most of those people are going to need some kind of pain medication, and they always occur at inconvenient times. So we ran a drug room which had a pretty full service component of medications available. The opioids were kept in a locked box. Each category of medication had a separate location in a notebook, so that at the end of every shift, and we ran 12-hour shifts, but at the end of every shift, the two nurses who had been on and the one coming on duty would sit down, and one would count the pills, and the other would observe the counting of the pills to see did they agree, and then they would check it against the medication list that was in the book, said how many pills were left at the end of the last shift, and how many are they starting the next shift with. So there's another question.
Well, at this time, was the healthcare in Yosemite Valley at this time when these guys showed up 24 hours a day? Because I'm assuming people need medications at any time of the day or night, 7 days a week. And at that point, you guys were on call or being called out? So I'm wondering,
we were on call. There was always a physician on call.
Okay.
Yeah, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Okay.
And there was a nurse in the building.
All right.
In the building and actively, awake and alert.
So this story, as you were recounting it, was happening when the Yosemite Clinic was still a hospital, or had it been downsized by then?
This is after the hospital was closed.
Okay.
But it was also during the time when we still were available and accessible 24 hours a day.
Got it. Thank you.
So that's how we would wind up having to have these things available at all times. And I'm going to break the chain of events here a little bit to explain why these guys were sitting there.
Okay.
And it turns out that our chief law enforcement officer, a year or two before these guys showed up, had, I think, thought that he was doing us a favor, because a couple of law enforcement people showed up in his office basically asking questions about the clinic and me personally and people who worked there. And this chief law enforcement officer saw that they were questioning whether or not we were dealing drugs. And the reason they were thinking this is because I personally was the person who signed, whose name was on all of the orders for any kind of a medication that required, was in one of the categories of opioid. And we used a lot. We had three doctors. I provided the medication for the people on board the ambulance, and for people at Badger Pass. They had a cache of some medications that they could give if they needed, on approval from talking to our medical control. And that was the advantage. See, medical control was at the clinic. So all around the park, 1,200 square miles, wherever there was a ranger who had a radio, they could basically call the clinic and talk to a nurse or a doctor and describe a situation, determine whether or not they needed an IV or needed transportation or whatever was available to provide a level of care that was above the old Red Cross, stable things, which was either put a splint on it or, very basic things. So they had come to Yosemite anticipating that they were going to do some kind of an investigation, kind of with the idea that the medical clinic, and me in particular, were in violation. And that, they were looking for an opportunity to hit somebody for being a dealer, in essence, a dealer. And he basically told them, says, no, you don't have to worry about the folks over there. They're all, upstanding citizens, and would never be involved. But then the folks who were looking at us were saying, okay, in the month of June, they received 1,000 pills of Tylenol 3 or something of that nature. They were looking at the, because that's the way it works in California, even though we technically were not under California law. Yosemite is an area of what's called exclusive jurisdiction. So that I didn't even have to have a California license. And the doctors I hired and the nurses I hired didn't have to have California licenses. They don't have to at the VA either. This is just your standard difference between state and federal rules and laws. The only person that I truly, really had to satisfy was the superintendent. If the superintendent was unhappy, and if we really got into it, you know, as far as being in conflict and so forth, eventually it could have wound up with the superintendent say, we need to put this concession contract up for bid, and technically speaking, this person is not going to get the bid. So it was like, California even then had the reputation for a high level of regulation, and we're talking 1970s. So it was always a pleasure to me to be able to say, you know, I'm free to practice medicine in the best way that I think possible, and if there's a conflict somehow between the regulation that California has set up to make sure that the folks who are practicing in large cities and in large hospitals and so forth don't really apply to us, and we can't be in compliance with what they're doing, we will take what they say needs to be done, and we'll modify it to be able to work in our environment. So that's all useless information, which doesn't have any, you know, you and other people who are listening to this are going to say, okay, get on with the story.
No, on the contrary, it makes sense. Basically, yes, you have the liberty working at a federal facility, following federal law to avoid state law, but that was never your intent.
No.
And so that's an important background piece, I think, here. And I can appreciate why the head of law enforcement at the park, sitting with these guys, would say, it's a clinic.
Mm-hmm.
They deal with drugs because it's a clinic.
And we knew them personally. I mean, you know,
sure.
We interacted with them on a daily basis, if not multiple times daily.
Right.
So that, you know, they had the closest kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Interaction.
Professional and collegiality?
Not even professional collegiality. I mean, the law enforcement and the medical facilities don't always get along.
Hmm.
You know, some people in the medical community are not really comfortable feeling like law enforcement has any jurisdiction over them. And we went through this on one of the prior tapes I finally had the Zen moment when I was talking to the chief ranger and realized, yeah, they have authority to basically tell me that there are certain things that I have to do to comply with their rules. And it opened the door for the rest of my career for being able to say, okay, I just have to keep them happy, and we all will be happier. You know, we'll work together, and that gives us a better result. So back to the story about the guys. So they left with, the law enforcement officer never even let us know that these guys had been there. That's part of the story. He never shared with us that these folks had been there and that he had taken care of the problem and he had basically sent them on their way. And so these people then, of course, went back, and ultimately, a couple of years later, they keep looking at these drug orders that are coming in from Yosemite for injectable Demerol and for, you know, pills and pills and pills. And they basically just said, okay, these guys are up to something, you know, at least fishy, if not, you know, illegal. So they decided that they would take a different tack. Rather than going to the law enforcement people, they would just come directly to the clinic and find out for themselves without anybody intervening. So here I walk in, like say, my hair uncombed, unshaven, my grubby day off clothes on, and I walk in and here are these guys, look, you know, very official looking. They weren't uniform, but they also were, you know, had that law enforcement attitude. And nurses were sitting there counting out the pills, and fortunately, they had just done it, you know, a few hours before, and everything was right. All the counts were normal. There was nothing abnormal about that. But they weren't satisfied with that. They also then, they spent a week at the clinic. They spent a week going through medical records, and of course they wanted to know, okay, well, where's your box of prescriptions? Well, we don't write prescriptions, we write it on the chart. And then or we write it on the actual bill. The bill then would say office visit, and then there would be a prescription written on the bill because it was going to be charged to them on that bill. And so that was the equivalent of a prescription. It was in writing, and it became part of the permanent record. And that's all that's required of a prescription. But it was nothing like what they were used to looking at in your average pharmacy, which was run by a different set of rules. The pharmacy people have their own hierarchy. And so, it was like, okay. So they stayed, like I said, they stayed for a week, and they did have some criticism. They felt that we should be more attentive about keeping the door closed to the, it was a half door, it was a Dutch door. And there was a constant flow of, that's where the radio was for the communication to the rest of the park. It was where the nursing staff kind of kept all of their stuff that they would use in terms of just particularly taking care of the medications. If a person came in and we sent them out with three different medications, the nurse then was the one who counted them out, wrote out the label for the bottle, kept track of everything. So there was this constant flow of people in and out. Well, there was always a ranger hanging around. So the rangers then would come into the, they'd listen to the radio and talk to the nurses. It was, like I say, it was a family type. One of the rangers once even told me, he says, I was kind of offended by it. He referred to the clinic medical services as a mom and pop organization. And that was a real put down as far as I was concerned. But anyway, that's what it was to a large degree.
Did he mean that as it was a friendly place to be?
No. He meant it as that I needed to tighten up my ship.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was in law enforcement. I mean, what did I get? This was just out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
When the guys from the DEA left, they had sort of a, what do you call it when you sit down with people and have a and how somebody is leaving and they've checked something.
Exit interview?
Sort of an exit review. Yeah, with law enforcement. Just to kind of leave to make sure that the law enforcement people were aware that they had been there and they did have some recommendations. But for the most part, we had no charges, no nothing. And it wasn't until after that, in conversations with a variety of people, first off, that I learned about the situation where the guy who had run him off 2 years before, and secondly, that these guys had pretty much made it clear that they figured, they were almost drooling at the possibility that they were going to take this doctor out in handcuffs, because it was clear to them that there was no way that we could justify the number of prescriptions that and prescriptions for the type of medications that require a prescription and were in the opioid category, that we could justify that. And so, see, the Park Service had like maybe three ambulances dispersed throughout the park. Yosemite was so much different than Grand Canyon in terms of the athletic type activities that went on. There were climbers up in the high country. Tuolumne Meadows was the company, the concessioner, actually had a climbing school at Tuolumne Meadows. So they ran, people through all kinds of, a lot of activity up there, meaning that a lot of people either bent something or would break something or would, have an injury that was going to have to be, and occasionally there were some really serious injuries where people did, as a matter of fall, and sometimes died. And so they had these, let's say, ambulances, at least three ambulances in different places throughout the park, all of whom had to have a certain number of medications on board. This is all standardized, you know. There was one of the rangers who was the official liaison between the medical facility and the rangers who provided in the field things. So it all got complicated. But this business with the guys that wanted to take us away, there's a funny ending to this. Do you remember the team of guys that were in Miami, and one of them was African American, and the other one was a white guy, and the guy, the white guy, was Don Johnson.
Oh, you mean a TV program?
A TV program. It was a TV program.
Miami something.
Miami Vice.
Was that it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're too young for that. Well, Miami Vice was very popular, and so everybody knew that there was this team of a black guy and a white guy who, you know, did all this Vice stuff. So guess what? These guys that showed up at my office, one of them was black, one of them was white. And, of course, they, in Butte County in California, the African Americans were, I don't know if there may have been one or two kids in our kids' high school, which had 400 or 500 kids in it, that was African American. So they were unusual. And one day, these two guys were in the pharmacy in Mariposa. I got this story from another source, obviously. And the law enforcement people of Butte County, Sheriff's Department.
You mean Mariposa?
Yeah, did I say?
You're saying Butte, which is Oroville.
Sorry.
You're meaning Mariposa.
Scratch all that, not Butte, that's another story.
Yeah,
this is in the county of Mariposa. Yeah, so the Mariposa County Sheriff's Department noticed these guys around town, you know. And so they noticed the car that they were driving, and they got the license number and ran it, and it came back basically with nothing, you know, to be able to say who it belonged to or what it was or anything. So these two guys were in the pharmacy doing something, just shopping.
Down in Mariposa.
In Mariposa.
Yeah, the Rexall Pharmacy.
Which is a town of 4,000 maybe, something like that. And a couple of the sheriffs strolled in and walked up behind him and introduced themselves and says, are you the owners of this vehicle? And then described it and or are you driving it? They said that they were, and then they pointed out that there was no identification, that the license plate did not match to anybody, and would they care to explain themselves? And so they basically had to, you know, in essence, explain to a law enforcement organization which had nothing to do with me or with the park. You know, I mean, this was strictly they worked in the same county and they worked as colleagues together, but the authorization and the hierarchy of the organizations were totally separate. There was no opportunity for the Park Service people to have called up the folks in Mariposa and said, "Hey, why don't you check out these guys? They're making trouble or whatever." So, but I have to tell you, I can laugh about that and not feel a sense of really being threatened, because I knew that there was nothing that I was doing that was wrong. They're perfectly justified. We made sure that we followed the law, that it required people listening to what we were doing and saying, okay, well, that fits this, that fits that, and you know, never. But one of my partners, who hadn't been with us that long, he saw it as being just intensely threatening to his future, his livelihood, his having to go to jail, his being castigated and
his medical license.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Oh, yeah. And so he never really quite got over that. I mean, it's always, and he, when I left and went to Grand Canyon, then he was going to be the senior physician. And he always was a little apprehensive about being willing to sign for all this stuff that I used to sign for, you know, and I trusted. And a lot of people would say, you're too trusting. But my attitude about being potentially threatened just by being sued, by possibly pushing the envelope in certain areas just in order, just because it was required to make things function in the environment we worked in, and same thing true of Grand Canyon, that I always felt that I felt totally comfortable in saying, I have no difficulty sitting down in the witness stand in court and justifying and explaining my actions and so forth. Never had to do it, but it was something that, but Gary just, I think, felt that he just did not have that kind of adventuresome attitude. So, so anyway, that's the story about the DEA and my experience. So what else?
Did you ever have a loss of control? I mean, you've got medications at certain stations all the way around. Did that ever, the numbers not count somehow, and something happened to you, have to be taken action against someone who was actually squirreling stuff away, anything like that?
You're right. I understand the question, and maybe I just got lucky.
Okay.
But it was First off, the nursing staff had all kinds of interactions with the ranger. The people who, and you're aware of the difference. I mean, in the parks, there's three categories of people. There's your law enforcement and firefighter group, and there's the maintenance department. And those two groups don't talk much to each other. As a matter of fact, they have a substantial amount of conflict. That just goes with the territory. That's part of being that. And then the third part, of course, is the hierarchy, the superintendent and the various district rangers, the chief ranger. They kind of make up their own separate organization.
The administration, if you
will?
Yeah,
just the administration.
Okay.
Sure.
And then today, of course, there's the interpretive rangers.
Right.
And of course,
there's that group out there.
I kind of left that out because that's another. But as providers of medical services, we had virtually no interaction with interpretation. They were their own separate entity.
Right. But they would come to the clinic for health care.
Oh, sure.
It wasn't that you worked with them collegially for medical control and first aid recovery because it was the law enforcement, fire, high wall rescue people that were taking care of that type of activity.
Right. Got it. Yeah. And also these were the people who interacted, not the interpretive ranger, but the law enforcement. The health, safety, and welfare aspect are the ones who had the most of a relationship with our nursing staff.
Yeah.
And the nursing staff, I mean, they were my guardian angels, you know. They were out there in the field, had their eyes wide open. This was not done in a vacuum.
And I have to add, and the nursing staff was, for the most part, unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the rangers were unmarried.
Okay.
And so there was that. Several nurses married rangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was that type of interaction, relationship. Yeah. And
so there was this really cohesive group of people who kind of kept an eye on each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anybody who really tried to just kind of be outliers outside of the trustworthy group, that nobody wanted to, and if they did, they got recognized pretty quickly by somebody else who kind of would just say, you know, let's keep an eye on that one. down, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So I never felt threatened, and as far as I'm concerned, I never was punished for being too trusting.
So the visit by the DEA guys ended, it sounds like, in some recommendations, which in a way you were very comfortable to embrace.
Yeah, and it was appropriate.
Nice.
Yeah, it wasn't like we were like they were forcing me to do something that was going to totally interfere with their ability to function and that sort of thing. Right. And when they left, they were gone. Mm-hmm. No, they never came back. Mm-hmm. There's a term for when pushback. Flyback, nothing like that.
How many other, I don't want to use clinic, I guess is the word, clinics operated in the entire state of California like that Yosemite Valley shop? Were there any other?
No, and part of the reason is because they were more rigidly forced to follow behavior on the part of the people who were their medical control people. And the second thing is, I'm trying to think of rural environments. See, this is the thing that's unique about a national park, particularly an internationally famous national park. They just don't. We covered this kind of in our first conversation. I looked at a lumber camp with 2,000 people in it and realized this is not going to keep me entertained or a whole lot of things. And the environment that exists, and if I'll reiterate, there were three parks in the national park system. It was Yosemite, Grand Canyon, and Yellowstone. All of whom, even Glacier, which at one time had a higher level of kind of like the clinic, and these various organizations started out as having been contracted physicians from nearby communities who would agree to come in and operate a medical facility, on a little bit of a looser basis, as things changed in the Park Service and in the world, they became more and more formal relationships. And I guess I've sort of been hinted that I've probably I outlived my usefulness to a certain degree, but also I hung on to some of the old tradition just because it had so much exposure to a variety of nurses and other people who, and also working with Dr. Sturm. It started with the guy who was there in 1935 and stayed there until 1970. So I learned from him, even though I was only with him for a total of 4 years, roughly, with 2 years of that I was in the military. But he was a very good mentor. And so I learned, I would just watch him, how he functioned, how he related to people, some mundane stuff tends to make people, at least from my perspective, I've been a victim of making decisions based on mundane things. Now here's something that's mundane. When Abe Sturm had the, was the chief, was the concession holder for decades, the hospital had to have some form of emergency lighting, had to have some sort of a generator, right? Got to have electricity. Well, when the power goes off to the entire Yosemite Valley, there's only in 1960, there was only a couple of places that had any kind of emergency power, and the hospital was one of those places. And we were the envy of the neighborhood because our electric system in the houses that we lived in, there were two houses right behind and the nurse's dorm, were hooked in to the hospital's emergency system. so that the houses still had electricity, even if the rest of the valley was dark.
Pitch dark.
Yeah, and when it was dark in Yosemite Valley, I'm going to tell you it was dark. But the hooker was that the gasoline tank on the generator only held 5 gallons. And Avery told me, he said, well, I mean, it was part of my work, part of my job. When he was gone and I was on duty, and if the power went off, I would have to get up at midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock and refill the gas tank or the generator. Now, how many doctors do you know who considered that part of their medical, you know, responsibilities? And I was a little hesitant about that. Do I really want to let myself into a job where I got to do all this other stuff? And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I got to get up in the winter, in the snow, in the ice, in the cold, and go down and put 5 gallons of gasoline in this generator. And I say, that came down finally to the conclusion that, yeah, I could do that. Now, while we were there, the Park Service acquired a, what's the rating of generators?
Kilowatt or megawatt.
It was 1,000 kilowatt. Okay. The Park Service, through the Army Military Surplus System, acquired this monster diesel generator. And you know, they found a place that we had a shed that they were able to squeeze it into, and it was always giving us trouble. There's always something about it, you know, that either it wouldn't start automatically like it was, but that was the biggest problem. Because what good is a generator, and particularly if the maintenance guys live in Mariposa, which is an hour away, and not about to come into the valley and start the generator. So I made it a point to get with the guy who was the electrician and say, okay, now you need to instruct me how to start this when stuck. And I had written down somewhere, there was a sequence of things that you were supposed to do. But that apparently was not acceptable to somebody in the maintenance department. I never found out who it was, but one day I walked out to the generator and there's a padlock on the door. And I didn't have a key. And so I kind of thought, okay, we'll see how this turns out. Because I figured, okay, now what they've done is they've given the key to somebody in the valley who's always available in the valley. And if the power goes off, then they will come over and unlock the padlock and start the engine. No. Basically, they had not really set it up that way, which I was kind of upset about, but did not care for that at all.
Rightly so.
And so, what did I do? I took an axe and knocked the padlock off, is what I did. Broke the padlock, took off, and they put another one on. And I took that one off. And we finally came to a draw. They quit putting padlocks on, and we came to an understanding that I was, like I said, we just came to an understanding how that was going to work.
I'm going to back up a little bit and say, well, gee, doctor, why weren't you smart enough to put in a 15-gallon tank instead of a 5-gallon tank, and that way you could have tripled your sleeping time in jest. But it's a matter of simply working with the Park Service to get a key. Yeah. Here are the people that need the lights on. They know when the lights aren't working. They just give you a key and say, yeah, you're instructed on how to turn on this piece of machinery. I can appreciate from a liability standpoint, they're like, no, we can't have somebody who's not a Park Service employee and not trained. Yep. In quotes, go do this.
And technically, it probably would have a liability potential of some kind.
Exactly.
And a variety of things. Yeah. But I got by with a couple of... as I look back on it, it's a miracle that I was not penalized somehow. And I'll just... I don't think we talked about the riots in the meadow, did we?
Not yet.
Before we get there, though, because I would like to know a little bit more about Ave, the 4 years that you worked with him. And I think you may have covered this in some of your other interviews, your old histories with people. But just so there are one or two things that you remember about him that might have helped you in your future career or helped you as an individual.
Well, they smoke like stove, which is not something that I did smoke for a while. After I got back from Vietnam, I had started smoking again over there. Hmm. And so I was still continuing to smoke, not a lot, but enough so that one of our daughters, after a while, got tired of it, and she left a note on my chair down at the office that said, "Dear Dad, this is no joke. Please don't smoke." And so,
And if you smoke, you'll choke or something like that.
But anyway, it was a sticky note. Well, you know, it was a small sticky note at that. But I figured, I don't have to smoke. If that's bothering her to that degree, that she feels, first off, that this is her best way of communicating with me. That's something to be, you know, at least considered. Where is the, how is our level of communication? And, but anyway, that was pretty much, that was the end of my smoking. I didn't smoke after that.
I have to go back to Abe.
So Abe is smoking like a chimney.
Okay. He was, he just was a Renaissance kind of a guy. He was a doctor. He was highly respected in the community. When I first went there, and kind of got into the was there for a year or two, and I realized that there were people coming to see him for their medical care from 2 hours away. They would drive up from the Mariposa or even partway to the valley, the Central Valley, where there were doctors everywhere. But these people had, from in 1935 and in the late 30s, the medical care that could be delivered at Lewis Memorial Hospital in Yosemite was pretty close to being on a par with what could be delivered at the hospitals, Mercy Hospital in Merced, because there was just not that much going on, and Ave would he did C-sections if necessary. I was trained to do C-sections under the most extreme circumstances and avoided them at all costs. But he did hernia repairs, which I did too. He actually did orthopedic surgery, which I didn't do. He was comfortable.
And wasn't he highly respected orthopedic wise with other doctors in California, particularly the Stanford group or Palo Alto Clinic group or whatever?
Yep.
Yeah.
That very true. No, particularly with Stanford. One of the people that he had, I don't know if he'd actually gone to school with him or had some other kind of relationship. Stanford used to be, the medical school used to be in San Francisco way back in, the 20s, maybe 30s, whatever. They moved it from San Francisco down to Palo Alto, which is where the Stanford University was. And so a lot of the people that Abe knew, he went to the UC San Francisco for his medical school training. So he was also then, he just had this network of docs that were in the Bay Area and who knew him from their past experiences. They respected each other. He was a smart guy. Exceptionally smart guy. I think he started his college training when he was 16 and graduated from medical school when he was maybe 21 or 22, something like that. So, like I say, he was an exceptionally bright guy, so I was really admired that. And just had nerves of steel. Never had a depressed day in his life, I swear, He said it. It was like, okay, I don't understand that.
So when you use the term Renaissance, do you mean that he was multifaceted as a physician to be able to do OBGYN, orthopedics, elder care, pediatrics, just the entire turnkey of medicine at the time, and keep all that together?
That And he also, I do not remember him as a person who was widely engaged in academic interests or art and literature and all that kind of stuff. But he was on speaking terms with it.
Hmm.
And like I say, here he was a senior physician, and I was a wet behind the ears, you know, still basically thought about the world in from the perspective of a resident, still learning and still needing a lot of assurance that I was capable enough to do this stuff.
He was the epitome of the country doctor that you see on TV from Marcus Welby or those other guys from the movie or the movies and TV and all the rest of it. He was just your country doctor, and the country doctor wasn't afraid. They did everything, and they weren't afraid to. If they were afraid to, they didn't survive. You know, they went somewhere else, and that's. And I've always thought of Jim as being your country doctor too, because of all the things that he did. And
see, one of the things that we got by with, they probably stopped as soon as I left up there, but the business of a person coming in with a dislocated joint of some kind, and really the only way to be you've got to sedate those people. You've got to provide them with adequate pain relief and be sedated to the point of very close to being in a level of anesthesia, just right on the verge of that, you know. And we did it, and the nurses were good at it, and they came up with the oxygen saturation devices, which we didn't used to have. Previously, it was, okay, check the blood pressure, and are they breathing? And all that kind of stuff. So we really never had a really disastrous result from anything like that. And it was so rewarding to everybody involved, a person with a Colles fracture to be able to reduce that and get it into a proper splint, to
alignment,
reduce
shoulders. Check it on the x-rays.
Yeah, but particularly the ability to do conscious sedation, is a term that evolved into, in an environment where there was no anesthesiologist, no anesthesia machine. I mean, in today's current environment, we were totally inadequately equipped to be even approaching putting people to sleep. And so, you know, people, I was prepared to defend that. When you compare the length of time to get from Yosemite to Fresno or from Grand Canyon to Flagstaff, if I had to sit in front of a jury to explain these things, I felt that I could explain them satisfactorily. Maybe if they were a jury of other doctors, they might have said, no, you really are exceeding the limits of your capacity. And so that's why I figure sometimes, well, okay, I've got to have just in time. But
Abe was sort of the driver of that. He was comfortable with that type of medicine.
Yep.
And,
absolutely.
And that's what was being practiced at the time.
I figured, well, hey, and I have to say this, blow my own horn. I had a couple of years of surgical training of some sort. So I did a pretty good hernia. And my partner, Roger Hendrickson, even told me one day that I did a better hernia repair than Abe did.
Oh.
You know, it's like,
well, that made you day.
Yes. Yeah, so it's I learned from him, but also learned from him in terms of things. Well, I'm not going to do it that way, or I think I can improve on that, whatever.
Yeah,
but I became his doctor. When he retired, then he would drive up to Yosemite.
Yeah, he moved down to Mariposa.
Yeah,
Okay. So it was within an hour's drive to come up. Yeah.
So anyway.
Hmm. What else? Anything you remember about him that was
about
that,
Abe?
Yeah, about that endeared you to him, or was charming, or an interesting story you remember?
He was a raconteur.
Oh,
He and his wife gave these parties in their patio, and his wife was this person who would hang lanterns and decorate the place. They just had this, and we never accomplished that. I mean, that's not our fort. But Abe and Pat came from that era of when entertaining neighbors and friends and so forth was really a big deal. And when we got invited to those parties, I can tell you, it was a big deal for us.
Wow.
We felt
like honored.
We were honored.
Yeah.
We had been accepted into the community as people who were worthy of being included in a dinner party at the Sterns, and there were other people who did it too.
And let me interject that to imagine what Pat and Abe were, two little short people, probably 5'5", and diminutive. I mean, they weren't round, and they were just both of the just and Abe had this little pencil mustache, and Pat was just this smiley, happy, someone you'd love to have as a grandmother, type of, both of them, and so that's the type of people, they didn't put on airs or anything like that, and it so anyway, well loved.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they were not just respected, but they were just well loved. That's in the community, and were very supportive of the community. It was a reciprocal appreciation, and
when we talk community, definitely the concessionaire, the Curry Company, everybody mixed in those days. I mean, you didn't stand off and this was your group and this one over here is your group and never the twain meets. Everybody mixed it up and it was one big happy family in the valley.
But we hit it at a very appropriate time, because we used to hear stories about what it had been previously when there was more of a divide. There was the park service people in their enclave, and there was the concession people in their enclave. And there was a certain, almost like a caste system. The concession people tended to look down on the park service, I think, is a fair statement.
Even in the same administrative strata?
They had a good ability to work together.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a question: are you going to let your kids play with these kids? There was some of that, yeah.
Hmm.
So it wasn't all beer and Skittles, So we could see that previously, and you haven't been around enough years to realize that back in the early part of the last century, there was the distinct have and have not. We're sort of seeing some of that now to a certain degree, but so we're going through some of the cycle that Teddy Roosevelt was huge influence on, from my perspective, reading about him. I wasn't alive when he was around, but reading about him and also because my parents very definitely belonged to what was called the progressive side of the progressive movement. And so I got really brainwashed in that sort of thing. So anyway, back to Abe. He was a mentor and a person who I tried to be like. Mm. I tried to take on the good qualities that I saw in him, and not adopt the qualities that I felt maybe were not as endearing.
Like hernia surgery.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
But it sounds like Abe had the ability to cross those dividing lines that may have separated concession from park service or stratified park service or stratified concessionaire. He was able to cross bridge everybody.
Yeah. He was. And, without getting off too much in the weeds, Yosemite in the years really just before we got there, particularly from about, I would guess, after the war, after World War II. So 45, maybe before that, but geez, I don't know if anybody, because even Michael Adams, Michael Adams and I were basically the same age. We were like 1 year apart and something like that in birthdays. I was born in 33. So, you know, in 1939, I would not have gone to Wasatch. And you're familiar with Wasatch. We've talked about Wasatch.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the wholesale diversion of kids to Wasatch started pretty much just after 1945. You know, they wouldn't have been going over there, I don't think, during the war. Things were just a little too, you know, difficult.
During the war, people weren't in the valley. It was the Navy. The Navy took over the valley, pretty much.
We haven't talked about that, but it's kind of a... it's part of the history of Yosemite, is that...
It was supposed to be a rest and recuperation place for the
Navy. Grand Canyon was that way as well during World War II.
So I don't know how
Al Richmond is studying up on that.
Okay. So I have no idea how many concessionaires remained in the park during the war, because a lot of people were going off to war to fight or do something else. And I don't know what the Rangers, if they still had a place in the park then.
They had a relative skeleton crew.
Yeah.
But certainly in the second half of the 40s, all through in the 50s, the Wasatch School, basically you would run out of the ability to school your family, your children, at the park, and you had to basically send your kids out away from the park, either a short distance or a long distance, and the academy was centralizing a lot of the Park Service families. The concessions families there at that one school.
And the good thing about that was that the kids at least stayed with their friends.
I see.
I mean, this is how I see it.
One night they were there by themselves. Yeah. They kind of had their own clique, I think, first off, it would be Park Service kids, and then there would be the Yosemite kids. Would be their own, you know.
As opposed to say sending your child off to San Francisco to a boarding school,
or no connections to anyone.
Where you wouldn't have a friend with you at all.
No, that's a good point. I had never connected that together. There was collegiality there amongst the school children.
And if they did decide that they were going to keep the kids at home and go to the local school past the eighth grade, it meant going to Mariposa, whose academic standards were really suspect.
At that time. Yeah.
Okay.
And so the parents probably made a pretty reasonable decision. Okay, we can afford to send them to Wasatch if they were able to do that, and that's what they would do to properly give their kids an education.
I'm not sure how we got there from Ave, though.
Well, because Ave and because his kids, the three kids, had two girls and a boy.
Yeah.
The boy wound up going to a Catholic school in the East Bay. And my brain just won't work properly to give you the name Livermore, the town of Livermore. Of course, all that area was rural. It was agricultural.
Livermore, was not, very much so.
Was it connected to the Christian Brothers in Moraga?
Maybe. In Moraga? Might have had a connection, but I don't remember.
Because I was thinking, because that was in that same area.
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't
really matter.
Yeah.
The point is that Danny went to that school. I don't know where the girls went.
I don't either.
But in any event, the life in Yosemite before our time came around, the Sturm kids had horses, and they were stabled. In the
valley.
With the concessionaire.
And you remember I told you that a night in the hospital cost $20 back in those days. Well, stabling a horse at the concessionaire's was going to be kind of in the same level of cost. This Bracebridge dinner that cost $1,100, when we were there, we could go have a meal at the Awani Hotel, and the regular price was $6. We were able to do it for $4.
Wow.
And it was still an extravagance. You know.
Well, we even went to the Bracebridge dinner. How did we get...
We pulled some strings.
Yeah.
Strings were pulled for us. Yeah. We got to go one time just as part of the things, and then we got to go as a couple of the people up here in the...
Yeah.
At the head table.
As performers.
As guests of
the head table.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Oh my.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was, there was a lot more kind of elegant stuff in some regards. Abe just really loved to tell about the fact that the girls would get their horses and unaccompanied ride the trails up to the falls, the back country. They would do it by themselves. They would come back down. They would ride to the house. They'd tie them up at the back door.
Yeah, well, one of the trails went along the back side of our house, up about 100 yards or so.
This is the kind of stuff like I just thought, man, that we were born too late.
Yeah.
But you know how that is. There's always two sides to that question.
That's right. That's right.
So anyway, okay. The thing is Abe and Patricia and Pat, we admired their ability to be the
gregarious.
Yeah, really gregarious and
socially adept
and
enjoyed it. I mean, they really enjoyed having people. They're the type of folks that would, if you came along down at the clinic and Abe was talking to somebody and one of his friends, and it turns out it was lunchtime. Oh, come on home, have lunch with Pat and I. You know, it's that type of thing. And I can remember my grandmother doing, it was that era that my grandmother and my aunts would do things like that too. That if you came to the door and it would happen to be lunchtime, come on, sit down with us. We'll, pull more out of the refrigerator and all the rest of it. And
I can't think of any more revelations for concerning Abe.
Then unfortunately, it's a hard transition because the next thing I'm curious about is the 70 riots. And how did that happen? What sort of set the stage for that?
What set the stage was that the hippie movement came to San Francisco in the late 60s. And so there was this incredible movement.
Against authority.
Against authority, free living, free sex, free drugs. This revolutionary behavior on the part of a large number of young people. And they tended to focus on the Haight-Ashbury, it was the place. Well, starting in about 68, 69, I had to go to the military at 68. We were already seeing the influx of people, counterculture people. By the time we got back from the military in 1970, it was in full bloom. And we were aware, we were hearing more and more discontent on the part of people with families, people who were accustomed to going camping in Yosemite for the experience, the glorious experience, camping in Yosemite. And everybody, of course, they didn't have any kind of a system of making reservations. It was first come, first served, and not even to have the, most of the campgrounds weren't even designated campsites. It was like, here's a big campground, find a space that's big enough to accommodate a tent, and it's yours. And the counterculture people then started kind of becoming more and more present in the so-called organized campgrounds, and the folks who were really outraged by the sexual behavior, by just simply the freedom in all aspects of their lives, were more and more offended by this. And we appreciated that. I mean, it was the kind of things that went on right next to a campsite that had a bunch of kids, teenagers or less. Whatever they did was pretty much out in full view of everybody. And there would be these little kind of skirmishes, you know. There would be people who objected to the behavior of the counterculture, and there would be sometimes words or, you know, just confrontational behavior, not necessarily fights and that sort of thing. But finally, it got to the point where the counterculture movement had gained so much of an impact in numbers that they were spreading out of the campgrounds into the meadows. And there was one particular meadow, same in the meadow, was
Stoneman.
It? Stoneman. Yeah, thanks. Stoneman Meadow. At night, it was becoming more and more a hippie
party.
Territory.
Yeah.
And just basically a party with many people out in those meadows. And the Park Service, the rangers, were increasingly, you know, trying to maintain some kind of control. There was one person there. Was Bob superintendent then? Bob Barbie?
I'm sorry.
No, he was not superintendent. He was not. That's a big deal. Because he was one of the...
He came in afterwards,
he was one of
he?
The underlings.
Oh, was he?
Who
okay.
was trying to make peace.
Oh, okay.
There was
I
a guy
know.
Who, by the name of Bob Barbie, B-A-R-B-E-E, who... Was a guy who was trying to learn about what was going on. You
sure.
know,
was he infiltrating? Well, not, it wasn't a true infiltrating,
no.
but he was.
He
yeah.
he would dress up, he would put some beads on and just regular clothes, not wear a uniform and so forth, and go out in Stoneman Meadow and sit down with people and talk to them. And, you know, and he was, you know, learning. Now he was far outnumbered by the group of people who were outraged
yeah.
by the law breaking, the people who
noise.
Were in violation
yeah.
of just simple basic civil behavior in light of those times.
What the campers expected to be.
Not just the campers.
Well, okay, and the rangers.
The campers
yeah.
and rangers and
right,
the social norms, if you will.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
yeah.
That's a yeah. That,
you
that's
know,
exactly
and even
right.
the concessioners. You know, if they come into the stores, they
yeah.
were probably suspect of, you know, are they gonna?
And they were, as a matter of fact, guilty
of stealing,
of shoplifting.
Yeah.
Their behavior.
Because they felt
in
it was
every,
their right.
Every respect
yeah.
and
yeah.
every regard. Was in violation and opposition to the social norms of the day
yeah.
At every opportunity, and so they had basically kind of taken over Stoneman Meadow, and the I don't remember the exact sequence. You could Google it, and there've been books written about it, so you could find out exactly what kind of led to what, but the cowboys. The Wranglers, who were the stable people, and Curry Company had, I don't know how many horses they had in Yosemite Valley in their stables. 100? Something like that.
You trail know. Rides all the
trail
time.
Trail rides.
Yeah.
5 or 6 trail rides in the valley per day, with trail rides up to the various places up in, you know, half-day rides,
yeah.
all-day rides. So there was and that meant that there were the people who led the rides, who took care of the animals. And can you imagine a group of people more different in their...
even
they,
nowadays.
It was
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
starting with the long hair.
Oh,
you,
yes.
I'm sure you must have heard stories about how people with long hair who visited the wrong bars and saloons in the West Jackson Hole was notorious for this sort of thing, taking people out and giving them a haircut and so forth. It was a big item. It caused a lot of angst and at least conflicting concepts, to say nothing of people wanting to do something more concrete in the way of conflict. So I don't know if it was the Cowboys or if the Cowboys and the Rangers somehow got together and decided that they would clear out Stoneman Meadow with a bunch of mounted riders. And I don't know how many they had, at least a dozen, maybe 20 or more, riding in a line, you know, basically trying to say, okay, they would herd these people in front of them. Hey, they herded animals all day long. Why couldn't they herd people? So they basically started out by trying to take back Stoneman Meadow.
And I guess, yeah, and they... I think they wanted them to go back into the camp or into the forest area.
That was the main object, was to get them to do that, was to just to get them out of the meadow and sort of disperse them, you know, so that they weren't in being a group who would behave like a group, like a crowd behavior.
The big thing in the New York, the hippie, what was the name of it?
Woodstock.
Music. Yeah, Woodstock. Had that occurred yet? Because
I wonder if they weren't thinking. Woodstock occurred while we were still at Fort Devens. Never knew it happened.
It's just up the road a piece probably.
But it was late. 69.
Okay, so that therefore. Yeah. You wonder if the Rangers were, and people were thinking, is this the Stone Meadows going to turn into a mini Woodstock? Mm.
You know, and I'm sure that was part of it. Yeah. And people saying we got to get control of this before it becomes, you know, like a Woodstock thing. So anyway, they tried to control the crowd, herd the crowd, disperse them, and they weren't being really cooperating, and it wound up it being basically a sort of a cavalry kind of a
charge.
Okay, yeah, instead of just being slow motion walking along and so forth, it turned into and I think there was some hitting of people maybe with sticks and stuff like that trying to enforce this.
Well, weren't the young people also throwing rocks back at the Rangers?
They were throwing rocks at the horses and at the riders and various things. So it pretty quickly deteriorated to just a kind of open warfare. And that's when the Rangers then put out the call to neighboring communities for assistance. So all of a sudden, law enforcement, yeah. That kind of assistance. So over the next couple or 3 hours, there were dozens and dozens of law enforcement people descending on Yosemite Valley, and they congregated, the law enforcement people congregated in the they had built by that time the Vista Center, brand new. Brand new, so it had a big auditorium kind of an arrangement. Seating for, you know, whatever, 150 people, whatever it is. Since I was not actually on duty, my partner, Roger Henderson, was the person who was on call for the clinic. Oh. But I was, you know, that left me so that I could be engaged. I went to the dispatch office to listen to some of it. And then...
How did you become aware that this was all happening?
Well, because the word... kind of was, probably, I may have gotten something from the radio at the clinic.
Okay.
And the nurses may have given me a call. Somehow, you know, rumors spread.
Yeah.
Probably the nurses would have called you up and said that there's a riot in the Stone and Meadow and maybe we'll need your assistance.
Standby or something.
Yeah, your assistance to help Roger.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So that kind of, I don't remember the exact sequence, but I wound up attending this midnight briefing with the all these law enforcement guys, and I swear to God, it was one of my most disturbing events ever, because they had these law enforcement people from these rural communities, Modesto, Merced, and all, who were just itching for, they couldn't wait to bash some heads and really teach these people a lesson. And the testosterone was simply unbelievable. And guys sitting in their chairs with their shotguns and jacking the slide, you know, it was the undisciplined nature to me of what was happening that I found very troubling, very disturbing. So they went through what they were going to do. They were going to split up into teams, and they were going to be going through the campgrounds and pretty much identifying people who might fit the description of somebody who would conceivably cause trouble, and they would arrest them and bring them, and they would triage them into the auditorium, where then they would be, you know, assessed, evaluated, and determine whether or not what they were going to do with them. You know, how many people could they transport down to put into jail and so forth. And this is the area where, like I say, as I've read these reports and read some of the subsequent then after action reports, there was obviously an investigation. So the people who investigated went on for months. And so these people submitted their reports. And I get mentioned in there, but never in a way that it makes me feel really I was just fortunate somebody didn't just come along and put the hammer down on me. Because my job, my sort of official job at the auditorium, was to evaluate people to see if they were hurt. Did they have an injury? Did they need to be taken over to the clinic to have laceration sutured or have an x-ray or, you know, whatever? And over the night, it turned out there were, I don't know, maybe 12 or 14 people who had enough of a reason that they were sent over to the clinic, and Roger took care of them. But I was the one who basically was, you know, I pretty much assessed everybody that was brought into the auditorium. So what I was seeing was that here were these, anybody who looked, who was a girl who wasn't wearing a bra, or who had a long skirt and long hair with something in her hair, was with a guy who maybe was both of them barefoot, just the typical, you have to have been seen enough pictures to know what these people look like.
I mean, this is racial profiling you're talking about.
Profiling. Well, just racial profiling.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, race is not the
as
word.
As a matter of fact.
You know, they're probably white, they probably look like this, go get them.
You've seen, I mean, what's the one with the motorcycle thing?
The Hell's Angels.
No.
Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Yeah.
You've seen Easy Rider.
Sure.
So, you know, the communes,
mm-hmm.
and the way that Peter Fonda and the other guy dressed in their motorcycles and so forth, they fit a certain
profile.
You would look at them and there would be an immediate thought process that labeled them.
Mm-hmm.
So these people come in labeled, with their hands behind the back, and with zip ties as substitutes for handcuffs, pulled very tight. And they were, you know, really miserable. They were, and here they were, you know, they'd been dragged out of their sleeping bags. It's not like they were still rioting. That's my point, is that they were going through the campground, and anybody that looked suspicious that they might have been involved or might have wanted to be involved, or might have indeed been involved, they were going to handcuff them and bring them to law enforcement was bringing them in. I started releasing them.
You were cutting their ties?
I was cutting their zip ties.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as I look back at it now, it was like I was this violator of the law. Law enforcement had brought these people in as part of a, quote, legitimate law enforcement engagement. And I was sitting there basically releasing them from their handcuffs. So I realize
You weren't sending them on their way.
No.
Yeah,
I was
just
releasing the source of their, discomfort.
They were probably pitifully grateful.
Yeah, they were happy to be released and made no effort to
run away,
to bail or anything like that. During all of this, by the way, when the the congregation of the law enforcement people was taking place, one of the sheriffs, and I don't know if it was the sheriff or a sheriff's deputy from Mariposa, came roaring into the valley, lights and siren, going full bore. And the way the road system works in Yosemite, there's a one-way road coming in, another one-way road going out. So he came in on the one-way road, made a turn, and right there beside Stoneman Meadow is a bridge over the Merced River. And it's got a fairly steep approach. And
so it's an arch, stone
it's
arch.
It's a sort of a stone
yeah,
arch.
A Stoneman Bridge is America. Yes.
And he hit that bridge. How fast? I don't know. Maybe 60, 70, 80, whatever it was. And became airborne. Came down and rolled it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was that Paul Page or whatever his name was?
I don't think it was Paul who was actually driving, but I've got to Google this and try and figure it out. But anyway, it was one of those moments in life, that was kind of incredible.
It's like out of a movie, right?
Yeah, it was. But I'll just reiterate one more time that I realized at the time, I said, to hell with this. These people are being treated poorly. This is not a correct way to treat a prisoner, regardless almost of what's going on, particularly for this situation, which is much more of a social war than it was really a true physical encounter.
And they weren't being belligerent or combative
at
the time
they were throwing rocks.
They were finally in the auditorium.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were very subdued in the auditorium.
Yeah.
And by the way, the person who was the chief ranger at Yosemite at that time was Dick Marks. So Dick Marks was actually one of the progenitors, if you will, of the Stoneman Meadow riot, which to me has always, it just has stayed with me. One of the ironies of life is, the heads rolled after that episode. Was Larry, I think the superintendent was fairly benign guy, wasn't, but boy, there was heads. Kind of like the situation now with the thing going on with the river people. Several underlings are paying the price for what went on, and they probably didn't have a whole lot of influence over it, but because they were part of the administrative structure, they're gone. And Dick Marks is one of the few people that I'm aware of who got out of that and was promoted.
Yes, but that's not uncommon in the Park Service, to move people along.
Oh, absolutely. But that public, the Stone Meadow riots was a major event. Every day there's people screwing up in one way or the other, and who ultimately have to pay the price, or a price of some kind, catches up with them sometimes, sometimes not. So there's always this constant sort of flow of people in trouble, out of trouble, being punished, being promoted, almost by accident. And in this case, it was kind of one of those, he dodged the bullet and became superintendent of Grand Canyon.
Would that have something to do with a change in director of the Park Service, too?
Could have.
You know.
I don't know who. As far as who knows?
Uh-huh.
And people are still writing books. That document that I gave you, that was that she's the one who wanted to publish a book that went into the effect that the Stoneman riots had on, in general, on the Park Service operations.
The influence it had?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And of course, I failed her by not. I don't know if she ever wrote the book, because we never completely finished it. I never proofread it. And she didn't feel like going ahead with it without my proofreading it, I guess. I didn't talk to her. So where are we?
Well, we were talking about the riots here, and I'm looking at the time.
I'm going to give you a little bit on on the change of going with Samaritan.
Right.
And of course, there's
let's finish up the riots. Maybe take another 10 minutes of that, and that's probably going to end our interview for the day. And then we can pick this up with with Good Sam.
Okay. Because also we still got the Becker thing to go through. So
right. Uh-huh. Right,
and that was between the riots and the Good Sam.
Yeah, I mean the riots were 1970, and Good Sam wasn't until 1986.
So it was a 14 years.
So we'll go, Chris, to Good Sam.
Yeah,
but at this point, what did you do with the people that came into the auditorium? You had to triage them. Some went to the clinic. Some might have been released at the time. When law enforcement realized the docs letting our people go, or you weren't letting them go, they were staying, they were just getting freed out of their out of their bondage, their handcuffs,
Nobody said a word to me.
Okay.
I was never punished or had any sort of retribution. The folks who went over to the clinic, you know, I identified the people who I thought needed something more than, you know.
How did they get to the clinic?
Oh, the Rangers took them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. So, what was the worst injury you saw?
I don't remember.
Okay. Out of the
but
bunch.
But nothing really serious.
Okay.
There wasn't nobody had to be sent out for further care, like to Fresno or Merced or Modesto.
Okay.
So no horses broke any limbs or cut anybody with their hooves.
Not
or
that I can remember.
Any of that
I don't recall anything.
And so the next few days. Again, you make a point that the Park Service, certainly law enforcement, is about control. And so one could say that they regained control of the meadow?
No, it was something that went on for several years, this rather constant back and forth. The counterculture people eventually took over a walk-in campsite over by Merced River.
Yeah.
Yellow Pine.
Yes.
Yellow Pine Campground.
Well, take it over, or did the Park Service decide that they would go ahead and designate this is where you can congregate?
They took it over.
Okay.
I think the Park Service designated it after they'd taken it over.
Yeah.
It was kind of the place where people would go. And it became such a there was fear on the part of the Rangers. None of them would go in there by themselves. And when they did go, just to, you know, kind of have a presence, and they would go with a group. And they invited me to go along one night. And, you know, I was basically a observer.
A ride along.
And with no particular duty, it was just that, you know, it was one of those, what would you call it, an armistice, in many ways. The people who went over there, for all practical purposes, kind of confined their activities to Yellow Pine.
Mm. Well, and it was removed from all the other campgrounds, really removed, all by itself.
And from civilization. It was strictly out of, you know,
it was
in the valley, but it was an isolated area, and they were pretty much, there was no enforcement regarding marijuana, alcohol, pretty much they were self-policing, if there was such a thing.
Well, they might have.
They might have. Yeah.
Maybe that was the arrangement.
What was Barbie doing at this time? Was he still trying to make that?
I don't really know whether or not he'd kind of given up on it. But I will say this, after he left, when he left Yosemite, I can't remember if he went directly to another park, but he ultimately wound up in Redwoods National Park, right after Redwoods had been declared a national park, which you may recall was a very unpopular thing in the Redwoods. I mean, anybody who sets aside an area like that gets blamed for whatever bad, like with the coal and Appalachia now is being blamed. EPA is being blamed for being the bad guy. Redwoods, you know, they were running out of redwoods.
Right.
And so.
But the loggers would have looked at as the takings of their jobs. And,
yep. Oh, yeah, sure. Of course.
So he Bob was made the superintendent. And when he left, they gave him an award, the community. Community.
Oh, the Redwood community?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just the community of I can't remember what town they were up to.
Yeah.
But the people living in that area gave him an award called the Walking on Eggs Award. So that tells you how good Bob was. Bob was able to take a really inflammatory situation. A hardcore guy could have gone in there and basically Dick Marks would have been a great example of somebody
down.
Who would have said, hey, you know, I'm the law here and you got to do what I tell you. Yeah, do it the way I tell you, whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bob managed to put together an organization that they never loved each other. But they were able to live with each other, and Bob was able to do the work that needed to be done to get a new national park, you know, underway and functioning and all, and did it in such a way that the community respected him and admired his ability to do that. And in all my, I kept track of Bob just in terms of kind of, you know, what's he doing, what's he up to. And it never changed. He was always a widely respected within the Park Service and outside of the Park Service for his ability to be to work with people despite having some real serious differences in their approach to what they thought was best for them and their organization and or their community or whatever.
Hmm.
So anyway,
interesting.
That's a Barbie story.
Awesome. All right, so with that story tying up Bob and talking about Abe Stern and the 1970s riot, maybe it's time to call this section a day, and we'll pick this up again back to the clinic with Chris Becker and Good Sam.
Okay. Well, that'll cover some territory.
Does that sound
but
like
you know,
a plan?
I have to admit that I don't remember a lot of really outstanding things happening between Becker came in 78. There was a lot of
this may go fast and suddenly we're launching off to Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So that's I just want to know where we're going to land again.
Okay.
and then we'll make a run for a run for it and see where we get. Does that
well you want to try for the 21st?
Yeah, I'm going to turn this machine off now.
Oh, sorry.
No worries.